Welcome everybody to the Longhorn Republic, your source for Texas Longhorn news, sports, and opinions with a bit of snark built in. We are a member of the 1012 Podcast Network. You can find more great Big 12 content over at the 1012 as part of the Sports Social Network. If you like what we do, please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps get the show out there. Share this with your friends where you found it, whether it was Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, anywhere where you find fine podcast content. You can find Kyle and myself. Connect with us on social media at Longhorn Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The Longhorn Republic. Shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. My name is Gerald Goodridge. I'm your host this week, like I am every week. And I'm joined by a man who can barely contain his excitement for football, Kyle Carpenter. Kyle, how are you?
I mean, we are just circling around the single-digit days. We are week-zeroing. We're getting sicko games on national TV. I think Navy kicks off the season. It's football time, and nothing says football time more than we get to bring Mike Roach on. We get to talk today's football that's starting in a matter of days, and all the stuff that matters for the next few years. This is what a time to be alive.
Yeah, dude, it is. I mean, there's football on the TV, college football on the TV that counts this weekend. It's absolutely insane. And as we talk about the schedule, I know we said last week we'd have an Alabama preview. Unfortunately, our Alabama guest hit us up yesterday and let us know that he is sick, does not have a voice right now currently to talk. So we're shuffling up our schedule just a wee bit. So we'll have both Alabama and Rice preview next week. We've got all those lined up. I think Carter will help us out. We're excited for that. And then we will have tonight, special guest, friend of the pod, third honorary member of the podcast, Mike Roach, will be here to talk a bit about the big recruiting wins that Texas had lately and kind of the perception, national perception. I don't know if you know this, Mike is on more of a national role, regional role now, so he's got some perspective there. We'll ask him about. There's officially like actual sports happening on campus. So down the 40 back in its full glory, soccer, volleyball, and beach volleyball, actually, both the indoor and outdoor varieties we represented today. And we'll obviously close the show out with some bang the drum. So I have been personally derelict in my duties and really just being a bad friend. It's been a minute since we've had him on the pod, the honorary third host of this podcast, Mike Roach, who's now what the official title, national analyst. What's your official title now, Mike?
Yeah, national recruiting analyst, 24/7 sports.
Look at that. National recruiting analyst, 24/7 sports. Mike Roach. We just call him Mike. We just call him our friend Mike. But he's here to help us talk a little bit of recruiting Texas. I don't know if you're paying attention, listeners. If you're listening to this podcast, you know this. Texas won a little bit of a national recruiting battle. So we'll talk a little bit of that and kind of where Texas is at momentum-wise and kind of national perspective. And we'll just ask Mike some questions. Mike's always good to have it on. But, man, it's so good to have you back, brother.
Yeah, you know, it's odd. Like, obviously, I moved off the Texas beat. I mean, my job is still extremely applicable, to what you guys do. So, I mean, like, I'm still free to come on as a guest anytime you want, but I feel like I've almost had to, like, I've moved on to the outside of, like, all of our friends on the beat. So, like, they see me as that other guy now. So, you know, I missed you guys. I didn't want to call for the ball, but you know, I'm available almost anytime you ask.
It feels almost like, I don't want to say retiring when Tom Brady retired, but you know, it's like a great athlete who just dominates his sport, like Roach did the recruiting world for so long. And then it's like you move on to the next thing. Maybe the more apt thing is, I don't know, someone who immediately became a great coach. You're moving into now mentoring the next generation as you sit atop the national pyramid, Mike. That's how I view you. The mentor, the sage, the man with, I don't want to use crystal ball because that has implications, but the man who sees it all, man, it's been too long. Hudson was getting too comfortable in that chair. We love having him on, but you know, it's too many without Mike feels like the show is lost its North Star.
Yeah. I mean, I hearken back to our COVID episodes where we talked about bidets, like what was, It's where we got the "What's Mike Watching on TV" segments going. So we go back a ways.
I mean, you birthed a whole new segment on the podcast. Our Godzillatron segment is born out of Mike talking about bidets. So like that is really what.
Yeah.
I mean, it. You know, it's
facts.
beautiful stuff. So we'll have to be on subject for at least a little bit, because that's what folks are coming here for. So we'll start with kind of the big name. Texas won a big recruiting battle against LSU for five-star all-world kind of must-have edge rusher Colin Simmons, who it was kind of, you know, sweating it out, and you know, they did a great job of keeping a lid on that recruitment. But I think you know, you've got a unique perspective because you know DFW better than anybody else, but also you have kind of this national perspective. So, like, how, from kind of the almost not the outside looking in, but from your kind of unique perspective, like, what, how big of a win was that for Texas?
It was massive, because I'm not sure I thought it was possible in the spring that they would win him over. And I kind of mentioned it in the reporting all the way up, and it made it, you know, it's, again, it's one thing to just be the Texas reporter and to feel that a guy is like one way or another, but like, to me personally, more than anything, I mean, my reputation as the guy in Dallas is like the most important thing to me. So, you know, I had some heated battles there over the summer with the Corian Gibson recruitment, and then going into Colin Simmons. Like, I, you know, I felt really good about Corian Gibson. I mean, I was holding the cards in that one. I had Corian telling me directly what was going to happen. So, as the rest of the market went against me, I felt very good, even though I called him like once a day, be like, "Are you sure you're not misleading me and everybody else is on the right track?" But with Colin, I didn't, and it was more because he did the best job I've ever seen of a recruit of like shutting all information down, because there's always ways to find out. You know, there's always, kids think that they're slick and they think that they can dupe people, but it's like a lot of times we read your head fakes. We know where you're going. Man, Colin had people spell, like, up until the announce, like, okay, here's to give you an idea. I kind of was always operating with the gut feel that it was LSU, like throughout the spring. I would talk to people around Duncanville and I would go, "I think in the end, Colin's just going to end up at LSU." And they were like, "Yeah, I agree." And I could never really get myself to believe that Texas had a shot, and moving into this new role as well. Like, for me to not, I mean, it's very important that I don't appear the homer, because I am interfacing with so many new fan bases and stuff. And, I told somebody at Texas, I need like triple verification before I'm comfortable like putting in a pick for Texas, because I'm gonna be harder on you guys than anybody else, than because I want to very much make sure that I'm in the right here. So to give you an idea, the week leading up, our Colin takes a visit to Baton Rouge, announces a decision date, and I mean, like, that whole week, it's kind of like, yeah, Texas is in there, but we still think LSU. And then, you know, I kept hearing a lot of confidence on the Texas side, like an absurd amount of confidence on the Texas side. And I was just like, well, I can't ignore that, but I also can't ignore the fact that everybody I talked to around the kid thinks it's LSU. LSU has the same amount of confidence. And I can't ignore the fact that Texas was that confident about Corian Gibson as well when I knew flat out, like, you're not getting it. So I kept saying, I need like a silver bullet. I need one thing I can really hang my hat on to change my mind at this thing. And I kind of got it one day. And it was actually like a myriad of different things. It was, you know, I kind of figured out how much of a role is NIL going to play in this recruitment. I had heard a lot of talk about how Steve Sarkisian was the best head coach recruiter in this equation out of all the schools. And I wanted to know how big of a role that was going to play. And like, I got that kind of confirmation. And so I felt good enough when I put my pick out. I felt good enough going into decision day, but like, I showed up to Duncanville and I was like, somebody literally said to me at Duncanville, "Hey, he's bringing out an SMU hat to put on the table. And like, we're not totally sure he's not just going to pick SMU." Like, and this was 10 minutes before the thing. So, I mean, there was never like a, "Oh, I feel great." I mean, everything clinched up until he made the announcement, basically. And so I think it was huge for Texas because, like I said, I just didn't see them winning it back in the spring. You know, I think they really made a big push in the summer. The official visit was huge. We did hear a lot of really positive things coming out of that. But I'm a big believer in the last visit before a decision. The buzz we heard out of Baton Rouge, obviously we knew Caden Durham was going there. At that time, I couldn't tell anybody, but I knew DeCorian Moore was going to eventually commit there. I mean, I think we, I don't want to blow DeCorian's spot up too much because I still have another year and a half with him. But they left Baton Rouge and called me and were like, hey, let's start making plans for the commitment story. And so I thought, well, with everything going that way and the two Duncanville kids going there, it was just hard. I really needed it a lot to believe Texas was going to do it. And in the end, they pulled it off.
So it's without a doubt, Colin Simmons is a huge player on the defensive side of the ball, something that Texas has wanted and maybe I think you could pretty easily argue lacked with his true, impact ability. But how does it impact the perception and perspective of Texas on the overall national stage? Texas went out, landed a guy like Simmons. Like, they did it. However late in the game it actually happened, they did it. How does that, impact the perception of Texas on the national stage?
Yeah, so first of all, like, whether it was NIL, whether it was whatever, like, who cares? I've said this all along, and, like, I made a comment a couple years ago about A&M and NIL when they signed the number one class, and it was said in kind of a flippant tone, but my sentiment was, your job is to get players to your school.
Yep.
Who cares how you do it? The NCAA has made it legal and codified now to do it. If it's NIL, if it's he really likes your colors, if it's he's got a girlfriend that goes to school there, whatever it is, who cares? Like, it's a results-oriented business. So my thing was, like, I don't know, who cares? Like, get him signed and get him in your roster and let him play. I think that the decade plus of mediocrity at Texas has made people forget that Texas is supposed to win recruitments like this. It's a in-state kid who's elite at a position of need that can come in and play immediately. Like, to be frank, like, they shouldn't be in a battle with anybody else. They should be making the overwhelming case. So it is huge. I do think that, like, it caught some eyes on the national stage. I think it caught some eyes in state. I think it caught some eyes with guys like Kobe Black, who you saw the crystal balls pour in for him after that decision. I think he definitely took notice. But I will say that I think that, especially under Steve Sarkisian, like, they've landed these type of guys in the last couple of years. Like, Anthony Hill was this level of player. Arch Manning, obviously. CJ Baxter, this level of player. Like, Kelvin Banks, this level of player. Devon Campbell. They've landed these guys. So I don't know, like, people – to me, this should be business as usual for Texas. And if they want to get to where they want to go, they've got to not only win recruitments like this, they've got to win more recruitments like this. And they've got to, they've addressed a big position of need. But when you look at, like, how cornerback recruiting is going, they should be winning more of those recruitments. I mean, I think it certainly caught eyes. But look, man, if you don't think, like, the first – loss or bad game they have, if there's not going to be rumors or people talking or anything about Colin Simmons, like, I don't know what to tell you. I think it's this is where they need to be to get to where they want to go.
So with that, Mike, you mentioned kind of losses, and I think the conversation that I've had with other folks that follow recruiting closely is, like, if Texas has the year that they're supposed to have, right, like, they're predicted win the conference, people are, I don't necessarily agree with it, but, penciling them in as a college football playoff contender, right, if they have the year that people are predicting, like, how does this momentum continue to build? Like, does it kind of get back to, Mack Brown saying we don't really recruit, we select? Does it ever get back to that point? If Texas can kind of summit the mountain again?
Okay, so first of all, I want to talk about, like, just the expectation this year. I was talking with a friend who said, like, if they don't win and I'm not just disclaimers. I am not advocating for Sark to be fired at all when I say this. I had a friend tell me if they don't win the Big 12, Sark should be fired. And I was like, that's a little harsh. I mean, come on. And then he kind of ran down. He's like, all the reasons. He's like, this is as down as the Big 12's ever been. Like, you don't have, even TCU, which was your foil last year, is, like, ransacked by graduation, all this stuff. And Texas has all the pieces they need. And I was kind of like, man, like, I don't want to call for anybody's job, but it's not a bad point. Yeah. Like, the expectation is at least very high. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that Mack Brown era of recruitment is ever – completely possible again with the state of college football. I mean, even, Look at Alabama. They lose recruitments to people. Look at Georgia. They lose recruitments to people. It doesn't happen as often, but it happens. But I think that the most fascinating thing to me is that Texas has been wrestling with A&M for the better part of the last decade, trying to figure out who's going to take control of the state. After Texas fell off the top, and then A&M was seemingly on top, and neither school can like stay on top long, it feels like, before it tilts back the other way. I think it's possible maybe to wrestle away control of the state and become the more dominant in-state program with a good year, especially, I mean, if A&M were to continue to struggle, that would obviously help. But overall, like, I just don't think that's the way recruiting goes anymore. I think with NIL, I think with kids now making more short-sighted decisions than ever. You know, I don't know if you guys know, I wrote a book. It's called The Road to Texas. I don't know. I haven't drummed up sales for it in a while. So in the book, though, talking to the guys, they were all like, you know, we wanted our parents to be able to watch us play. So we stayed home. Like, we didn't think about going outside of the state. That's just not the case anymore. And so I think that, I don't know that you'll ever get there, but I mean, this is an elite recruiting staff. They've proven that. I don't know what they're going to finish this year. I don't think they're going to have quite the juice to be a top three, top five class, maybe outside top five or right at top five. But this is a group that has proven over the last couple of years that they can recruit and close at an elite level and bring in high-end talent. So, I mean, I think more winning only helps that. You can maybe make a run at a number one class with better record, but I'm not sure that you can ever completely get it into autopilot. But, and I don't know that you want to, because that was ultimately what the downfall of Mack Brown was.
So I have a kind of a process question, Mike, because you have insight, and I've been curious about this, and I wasn't going to let you get off here without asking. So first year Sark was here, you know, we all have heard the story, looked at the room, this needs to be overhauled, we need to change this up, our roster construction, get ready for SEC. That was started by kind of that epic offensive line class. It felt like last year there was a real emphasis on linebacker, obviously, you know, at the top with Anthony Hill, but just, you know, solid contributors across the board there who could really define that group for a couple years. This year with Simmons and some other guys on the table, like maybe, you know, Dominic McKinley from Louisiana with the decision coming up, it seems like maybe his defensive line or edge could be the priority or one of the priorities this year. Is this intentional from what you understand, that, or is this a coincidence of Sark just in the beginning kind of rebuilding each block
and it won't be that way going forward?
I think it is somewhat intentional. I think they do have focus points every year. You know, last year or the first year, it had to be offensive line. I mean, it was 15 years of neglect and what it had done to that position room and what it had done to the program overall. It had to be that offensive line group. And man, to just kind of, it's weird now. Like, I'm not in it. Like, I talk to people on campus, but I'm not digging for notes on like what happened at the scrimmage on Saturday. So like, I've just become a fan of Orange 24/7 now. So I'll read the practice reports and like just seeing DJ Campbell's doing well at guard. You guys know, makes my heart extremely warm. That's my guy. But like, that offensive line group is paying off, right? Obviously Kelvin Banks last year, Cole Hudson played a role, DJ Campbell. And then I think the group Flood brought in last year, you're going to see some guys out of that. Trevor Goosby already making noises. I think extremely notable. And so I remember at the end of that cycle, there was a discussion of, do we take the linebacker that we're not wild about, but like fill a role, fill a number, or do we just take a seventh offensive lineman? And it was like, let's go seventh offensive lineman. I think it ended up being Malik Agbo was the seventh offensive lineman. So I think that there are focuses, and they knew the next year, because they had neglected the linebacker position, you almost have to in a lot of spots, rob Peter to pay Paul, that they had to go take care of that. It was big. And I think they've done a really good job everywhere the entirety of their time here, except for the defensive line. This had to be a big defensive line class. And it's turning out to kind of go that way a little bit, especially if you can close Dom McKinley and a couple of other targets. I mean, again, back in the spring, I looked at the board and said, I don't know how Bo Davis is going to put together a class. there's nothing that seams up at this point. And so, you know, they've done a good job. They need to address pass rusher. Like, getting Colin Simmons is great. They need more. I mean, they need more cats like that can rush the passer. That's, again, you know, I feel like it's been a personal campaign of mine since I've been covering this team to write about the fact that Texas just doesn't recruit elite pass rushers anymore. And that's going back to, like, Charlie Strong days. I mean, the last I can remember, like, maybe Alex Okafor, and then feeling like, okay, here's a drought forever. And then there was a little taste of Joseph Asai, and then here's a drought forever. And it's like, they've got to add more on the edge, but especially transition to the SEC, they need more of those big body interior D linemen. And you know, you saw what the D line did against Bama last year. I think it was encouraging, but like, those bodies are moving on. You know, Tavondre Sweat, you know, Keandre Coburn's gone. Tavondre Sweat's not going to be here when they're in the SEC. You know, Ajomo's gone, so guys like that. So they've got to get bigger up there. They've got to get more athletic up there. And yeah, I definitely think it's super intentional. That's the thing that sticks out to me most about the way Sark recruits, is a lot of it is very intentional. The way they do things, the way they set up their calendar, like, the way everybody panics throughout the spring because there are no commits, and then they go crazy in the summer. I mean, it's he and I have, like, I've had him on the record talking about, like, yeah, that's intentional. We want the summer to be kind of the focus and the center of our recruiting class, and then finish off in the fall. So I like that. I like guys who have a plan, and, you know, right, at least at the end of the day, if it all falls apart, if it all fails, you can be like, well, you know what? We executed our plan. It didn't work out. But it, you know, at least we had some rhyme or reason to it.
No. So you mentioned Don McKinley and Texas's need to, like, continue to bolster that. So let's just, like, camp out there for a second, right? Decision coming in what, like, 10 or 11 days, first day of September. LSU has not been one of the kind of names that's been in the conversation heavy. You know, Texas, OU, A&M, Ohio State have kind of been the leaders, but. You know, one, like, I think the first question is, you go and look at, like, the Louisiana recruiting rankings, and the top, you know, six guys, five of them have committed to LSU, and then you've got Don McKinley out here kind of doing his own thing. You know, I guess, how did Texas and other schools position themselves for this, and, you know, handicapping it, like, you know, 2 weeks out, like, what's your read on it as it stands right now?
So I'll lead off by saying that my new role, I'm supposed to be covering, like, the region. But right now, I'm mainly only covering Texas. I'm dabbling in Louisiana, dipping my toe in Louisiana, but I have not got real deep into that recruitment. I can only tell you kind of what I know just by talking to people. I've never spoken to McKinley. I've never spoken to anybody around him, but talking to people, like, at the college level, it was always understood that he wanted to go out of state, and that his parents wanted him to go out of state. I believe his mom is a teacher. And if you guys aren't aware, the state of Louisiana education system is not the greatest. So I think she understands that. She understands some of the funding issues that they face in that state. And I, from what I have heard, again, I'm not saying this is gospel, but I think the push has always been to get him out of state. Not to mention that Texas does well recruiting Louisiana because Bo Davis has done it for a long time. Terry Joseph is a native New Orleans. He's done it for a long time. Brandon Harris, native Shreveport. There's a lot of ties to that area and a lot of people they know. So I think that that's what's gotten them in it. A&M has always been extremely good at recruiting Louisiana, like, basically going back to someone when you think about, like, Speedy Noel and guys like that. Like, they've gone into Louisiana and gotten studs. I mean, Jacoby Matthews is on their roster right now. So they've done it repeatedly. Oklahoma, I think, is in it. I say all that to say, like, everything I hear right now is that it comes down to Texas, Oklahoma, or Ohio State. And I say all that to say that one person I spoke with thinks that it's Ohio State, and then it's a Louisiana kid. So if he shows up either on announcement day or on signing day later this year and is like, I'm signing with LSU, nobody should be surprised. I mean, we've seen enough of these where, like, the kids are like, I'm getting out of Louisiana. And for people that have never really been down there, I don't think they understand the, like, the pressure almost, or what the push is for those kids to stay in state. I mean, it's, to me, it is the best job in college football from a recruiting perspective, because you have this pool of talent And it's not always the deepest, but it's always really good at the top. And you can also go into Texas and draw some, and you have virtually no opposition in your own state. Outside of maybe Alabama comes in every once in a while and gets the top guy, or Georgia or something like that. But you're largely running uncontested. And so, you know, Louisiana recruitments are, you think you got them figured out. I thought I had Jordan Matthews figured out last year, and then they'll flip on their heads real quick. So I think right now my best read is Texas or Ohio State. But it would not surprise me at all if LSU is the pick either that day or if it just eventually becomes where he signs.
Other than McKinley, there's a couple other guys, you know, big five stars still out there. Not a ton, but there's a you know, if you look at the full talent board on 247 of five stars who aren't committed somewhere, Texas has, you know, a lean or a favorite for a couple of them. There's a few that probably Texas fans would like to have that they just may not. Bussy, Hudson out there. But, you know, Kobe Black, you already mentioned, Wingo, Brandon Baker. I mean, how much is still left? You said you don't know if there's enough juice, I think, at the beginning to get to a top three class. But how much is still out there as far as big names that are going to get the casual fan excited in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I think, look, if they sweep all those guys, they can get to a top three or top five class. But I think they're going to sweep all those guys, probably not. There's a lot of meat on the bone still. I think this is going to be a smaller class for them. And again, I'm operating on a lot of like information of what I knew in June before I took this job. And, you know, I certainly still talk to people there, and I certainly still like, but I'm not as in the weeds of like, what is your class size going to be and what's it changed to this week? Cause I don't like, that's not really what I do anymore. So I still think this is going to be a smaller class than it has been the past couple of years. You know, I mean, it'll adjust to whatever they lose in attrition and what they want to spend in the portal and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, yeah, Kobe Black, I think, is in a great spot. I've got a crystal ball in for him to end up at Texas. Ryan Wingo, that one's going to be fun from what I hear. I'm glad I'm not covering it. And given what Missouri just did to Oklahoma, I wouldn't laugh too hard, Texas fans, at the Williams-Winery thing, because they may be coming for Ryan Wingo next via the new Missouri NIL laws. If you haven't heard about those are making things interesting. Brandon Baker, again, I mean, everything I heard on it when I was on the ground covering it was like, this is going to be a very NIL heavy recruitment. And that's the thing. I don't think anybody wants to like talk about this, but like Texas is one of the most competitive NIL teams right now. And I think they should be. I've always thought they should be. They have the resources to be. I don't think it's always the number one thing or it's the only thing that wins a recruitment, but I don't think they're going to get beat on the virtue of losing a battle over NIL. And that's how it should be. I think it's funny because you'll hear Steve Sarkisian talk about it and he'll say stuff like, well, you know, we're just a relationship-based recruiting and we don't worry about all that. And it's like, all right, but you do. Like, you may not be personally, but your collectives are working. You know, they are working at a very high level. Put it this way, I talked to a source on the NIL agent side who said that there are a lot of schools out there that offer something and they don't always deliver once those kids get to campus. And they know that Texas and Tennessee are the two schools that if you feel you're going to get something out of them, you will 100% get something out of them. So those are the schools that they push these NIL agents are pushing their clients toward because they know that those schools have come through on what they've said so far. So I think that they're going to be competitive for Brandon Baker because they are competitive in the NIL space. But I do believe, put it this way, I don't know if he still is doing this or not, but I had heard, and I talked to Brandon Baker once, and he did not, I will say, he did not ask this of me, but I heard he was asking reporters for money to conduct interviews. Like, he was charging a fee. So if he's doing that, then, you know, who knows?
Okay. man, so let's shift over to, you know, the last question, I guess, football-y question we'll ask is, like, you know, you've covered Texas from the inside, and now you're kind of, you know, you still Texas, you know, the state of Texas focused, not necessarily the school, but, you know, taking a more national perspective, like, Texas is coming up on a big jump. I don't know if anybody's aware, but Texas is playing in the SEC next year. So, yeah, I know, shocker. So, like, from your perspective, do you think that what Texas has done roster-wise, whether it's transfers, whether it's, you know, the high school signees, do you think that they've done as much as they can to kind of prepare themselves for that move and kind of put themselves in a situation where they're not going to fall flat on their faces?
Yeah, they have. I would love to see them. They got to do more on that defensive line, because it's great if you get Colin Simmons and Don McKinley and guys like that, but they need more. I thought signing one interior defensive line guy last year was a mistake. But yeah, I do think that the roster in itself is in a better spot than kind of it's been in a long, long time. I mean, they are, if you go down, like, you look at it kind of as from a long view and you're like, oh, it's fine roster. But like, you go down position by position and you're like, okay, this is the best running back room in the conference. This is probably the best quarterback room in the conference. You know, the receiver room, I think, has grown a lot based on last year's class. The offensive line's gotten better. The linebackers are strong. Like, the secondary is good. You know, the defensive line's like kind of the one thing missing, but I think that they've done a great job really flipping that roster around, and that the, you know, eventually that move to the SEC. I don't think they're going to come in and just start kicking down doors immediately and dominating the thing, but I think that they're a lot closer than they were. I'll put it this way, I think they're a lot closer than they were the day it was announced that they were moving to the SEC, and everybody looked at their roster and said, oh my God, how's this gonna play over there?
Yeah, I think we'll ask you about what you're watching in a second, but the last thing I'll just say is I think probably the thing that no Texas fan will ever rewatch is that Arkansas game. And that was that's what you point to as the rude awakening of just getting outbodied. And it's happened twice with Arkansas. It happened in the Texas Bowl in the Charlie Strong years as well, right? And Arkansas isn't the most talented team in the SEC, but they certainly are just a team of big physical specimens on both, you know, sides in the trenches. And so I think you're right. Like, I think if you were to play Arkansas again next year, 2 years, it looks a lot different probably than a time when Texas just wasn't built that way. So now on to the fun stuff. What does the originator of the segment, which is now called Godzillatron, the man who, you know, can churn out 100,000 words a month and still polish off a dozen shows. Now you're in a phase of life where you have something else that takes up a lot of your time, surely, with the new dad role going on, in addition to the new job. So with whatever time you have right now, what are you watching? The people are all here to hear. What's Mike Rush watching?
So I try to balance the kid shows for her. She's 5 months old. Like, the kid shows are good, but it's not like she's like, I want to watch this. Like, she doesn't know what she's watching. It's not like I'm showing her, you know, The Sopranos or anything, but like, there are lots of times I watch what I want to watch with her, you know? Yeah. So kid shows are big right now though. Like, and I got to the point, like, we kind of did all the traditional, like, Sesame Street and all that stuff. And I got to the point where like all the Elmo screaming and like the crazy colors just like overstimulated me to a level that we found these shows on Netflix, kids, that are like perfect. They're like very low energy, kind of like quiet, cool colors. It's like a Trash Truck is the jam, Puff and Rock, Llama Llama. Those are like the three that I really, Peppa Pig, I think my wife has put on for her a bunch of times. And so now we walk around the house speaking in British accents, and calling each other Mummy Pig and Daddy Pig. And then Miss Rachel, the goat, Miss Rachel. And I like Gracie's Corner.
Yes.
For those unfamiliar, I mean, with my story, we adopted. And so our daughter is not genetically from us. She is of Hispanic descent. So I want her to have a little more culture in her life, a little more rhythm. So we bounced some Gracie's Corner in there as well. As for me, so in the last, like, probably since we talked, I got into Succession and then I got out of Succession kind of midway through. I probably need to go back, but my wife was just like, I'm done watching this. It's like the same thing every week and it's not interesting. And I was like, well, I'm kind of still in. I'll just watch it by myself, but I haven't since that time. I've gotten her onto Righteous Gemstones, which was an awesome move. I mean, she's really enjoyed that. I've gone back. What was I? I watched, been doing a lot of movies too, just like old movies I've never seen before. Movies from the 90s that I grew up with, but it was like, I never saw that movie, but I'll watch it now. You know, like things like, I'll lose, like you lose like your man card for this almost, but like, I'd never seen Heat, and heard people talk about Heat. So I was like, I'm going to watch this. And it was great. I get why people love that movie. So things like that, of course I watch a lot of, anything hockey. It is off season now, but, I'm ready and waiting for the hockey season to return. I feel like there was something else that I was on. But I can't remember what it is. There was another show that I was like, kind of, oh, The Bear. I've watched like a first half of the season of The Bear. And I don't know what you guys' opinions are on the show. It gets like a lot of hype. And I kind of just think like, yeah, it's a good show. Like, it's nothing that I'm like starving for when I'm not watching it. Like, I need to get back to it. It's fine. Like, I don't mind watching it at all. I enjoy it. But I think people, in my opinion, are too quick to try to crown shows as like all-time great shows. And it's like, brother, I grew up in the golden era of HBO Sunday nights. Like, I mean, Sopranos, The Wire, like, you know, Game of Thrones. Those are great, like, all-time shows to me. The Bear is a good show. It's just not, I wouldn't put it there.
There's something to be said for the, like, the eras, right? Like, there's, you know, in music, you know, you have the big 80s and then you have the alternative and lo-fi like rush back. Like, you kind of, I think because it was so good and then it veered and now it's veering back, but it can't go all the way. Like, it's finding its space. It's almost like, I don't think anything will be that sweeping and that big also because there is no like monolith that everyone watches anymore. Like, there is no singular cultural show since Game of Thrones ended, I don't think. Gerald and I are both fans of The Bear, but I totally get what you're saying. Like, it's a lot more shows where a lot less happens, I think. Like, it's like a super micro zoom in, and sometimes we're in an era of getting really deep, and that can be really fascinating or technique driven. But yeah, sometimes just the big bombastic, like, this is the most fun show I've watched. We don't get as many of those, and if you do, you have to really cherish them because it may be the only one out there.
Listen, I enjoy The Bear. It's a good show. It's well written, like all those things. It's enjoyable. I just like, even if you want to talk about a show where nothing happened, like Mad Men is an all-time show to me, right? Like, The Bear's not on that level to me. And so like, I just, people talk about it like it's the best thing. I thought Succession was kind of the same. Like, I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed like following it, but I was never like, this is an upper tier HBO show to me. It's like a tier two or tier three HBO show.
Have you gotten to you said you got out, have you gotten to the part where Logan rapped for his dad? Because that's when it, it went up for me to another level.
No, but I've seen that scene. So like, I know I'm on TikTok, so it pops up from time to time. Yeah. No, I haven't got there, but like, I think to the positive of Succession, it was a very defined like storyline of like, we're going to tell this story. It's going to start here. It's going to end here. We're not going to stretch it out. And I think that's awesome because I don't think enough shows do that. I just think that you didn't have I think streaming has also changed the game to a point of like, I do think that there was this element with Succession, but there isn't. Do you guys, I mean, like, remember what like early, hey, it's time to watch Game of Thrones, everybody at once watching Game of Thrones or one of those types of shows. I think streaming has changed that a little bit. There's not like with Succession, there is. I see it on Twitter. Like, there is like, it's Succession Sunday night. Can you believe what Shiv did? That kind of stuff. But like, I don't think you get the full on build, which I don't really need. I mean, the show's either good or it's not. You know, there are critically acclaimed shows that just people went crazy for that. Like, I've tried to watch Breaking Bad front to back 5 or 6 times and just want, like, cannot do it and wonder what is wrong with me for stopping every time. But Yeah, I just, and people love it, and I'm like, good for you, man. Like, that's awesome. You know, not a, like The Shield is one of my favorite shows of all time. Not everybody loves The Shield, so I get it. Like, it's you know, it's not always there for everybody. But yeah, I think those are good shows. I think everybody's starving for like a truly all time like kind of great show again, though. And I think that we were in that era where they just kind of stacked, like having The Sopranos and The Wire like kind of run concurrently. You don't get much of that more. And so I think that we were just kind of blessed in that era.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think part of the bear hype is not necessarily the show itself, but some of the quality of acting in that show, I think, is probably a little elevated from where what we're seeing. Richie. We all love Richie. On the kids,
I also just like love seeing things being cooked. I mean, like anything.
Agreed.
Anything that focuses on like a kitchen, I'm just locked in on. I'm trying to be a better cook. Like I'm a decent cook, but like I'm trying to get my knife skills better and stuff. And things like my wife she commented on something I cooked tonight. She was like, oh, you slice these peppers really nicely. And I was like, yeah, I'm getting my knife skills up. So, you know, anything like the movie Chef for me is like a good movie,
but
it's just like watching him make food. I'm just like, this is what I love about this movie. So that's a big plus for the bear.
Yeah.
Are you a food TV guy? Do you watch like cooking shows or cooking competition shows? Cause I know you're a reality competition show guy.
Yeah, I probably should be, right? I probably should watch more food TV. I never have. Like my wife likes she likes the baking shows, we're going to make a giant Santa Claus out of a cookie show. the Great British, whatever. Mm-hmm. I probably should. I find myself more like people who are online, like on TikTok or Facebook or whatever with recipes. I'll be like, anytime I see it starts and they could like throw like six ingredients in that. I'm like, I know right away. Like I'm not going to do that. I still watch it. Cause I just like it. I like watching it being done. So no, I probably need to delve into food TV.
Top Chef. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
If you like the movie Chef, the Chef show on Netflix, Favreau and Roy Choi,
solid starting point.
I did watch that as well. That is really good. And they go to Franklin's at one point.
They do.
I was going to say Top Chef was in Houston, and my wife had never watched any of the Top Chefs, and obviously living in Houston, you know, there was a draw. But she now like wants to watch as they come out. We watch London and, you know, et cetera. So a Top Chef fan was formed from watching, not that you have to start with Houston, but it may be the only Texas. Is there an Austin season?
There was,
I don't remember. There was, right? Yeah. So I don't know if Dallas has been in there. You'd recognize some more spots there, Mike. But a Texas bent to Top Chef could get you into a cooking food. Maybe that's.
Can I find Top Chef somewhere?
Oh yeah,
I'm 99% sure because I think someone I talked to went back and did like all 21 seasons. There's a lot of seasons, but like watched them all. So I don't. I assume they didn't go buy those. I think you can. I can't say definitively, but I'm very very sure that you can.
I believe it is on streaming on Peacock. Is where you can stream.
Okay, cool. So, one of the services I do pay for.
So. There you go.
And
on the kids' YouTube programming, Mike, if you look for some of the little flavor, Snoop Dogg's Doggyland actually has some solid stuff as well.
Yes, we watched that one. It's insanely like it. The problem with that show, it gets too catchy.
Yeah,
and then I'm walking around singing those songs all day long.
The Affirmations song is not far from my reach. That's a morning listen for us every morning on the way to school. So Mike,
which is great because like I want her to know those things and affirm those things. Like I want those. You know, I think that's going to be big for us when she gets a little older, start singing along.
Yeah, there's no one better to be than myself. I learned that from Snoop. Mike.
Yep.
If we got to get you out of here because it's been like 42 minutes, so we really appreciate you giving us so much of your evening. Man, if folks want more of what you've got to offer, where can they find you on the internet?
You can find me at MikeRoach247. What you might find when you go there, I'm going to tease this. I may be at war with an ISD again over media policies. I just got an email in the middle of the show about a media policy at one of our Dallas area ISDs and recruiting media. And I'm trying to give the athletic director like, hey, let's talk about this behind the scenes before I book you on Twitter type of deal. Like, let's work it out here. I'm offering diplomatic options right now. They're not, they don't seem so receptive according to this last email I just received. So when you go to at MikeRoach247 on Twitter, you may find me at war with a certain ISD.
I love that Sopranos is not just a show, it's a lifestyle for Mike. He tries the diplomatic, but I might have to come with the muscle. I respect it.
I've done this before. I've gone to war with Frisco. Frisco ISD. It was a long, bloody war. I just feel like, to me, and people get mad because they're like, well, you're complaining because you can't go there and it's costing you, like, whatever. It's like, no, not really. Like, there's a lot of other districts I can go to, a lot of other games I can go to on any given night. It's more of like a, I don't want their kids to miss out on the coverage that they would be getting from these kind of sites. And people just don't understand that, man. And so, like, I feel like I've got one of the bigger platforms in the industry, so I've got to do my duty when it happens in Texas to kind of speak out on it and get it out there and get it. And we get asked a lot, like, why don't you cover this school? Why don't you cover my kid? And it's like, oh, your school won't let us come out and do it. So that's kind of what it is.
Well, Mike, we appreciate the light you shine on these kids. We know that that's why you do it, brother. It's something that one of the reasons we appreciate you, Mike. But man, thank you so much. We'll have you back on again. But like we say this every time, we need to make it more frequent.
Yeah, well, you know, nights are easy when we do these night recordings because my wife gets home and she gets tagged in for a couple hours before. We have a very unique schedule. Like I don't think any husband like I love. First, let me say, I love being home with my daughter every day. Like, it's awesome. I don't think I'll ever get this time back. Like, I try to remain cognizant of that, even when she's, like, screaming in my face. And but, like, we have an odd schedule I don't think anybody would take, whereas, like, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I'll do nights and you do mornings and stuff like that. It's like, I do nights and I do mornings. So I put her to bed and I wake up with her. So luckily she's been sleeping since about 4 weeks. She's been sleeping through the night, so I'm told that's not very common.
It's not.
Gerald, you and I talked about that offline. So man, she's been awesome in that aspect, so I can kind of do my thing, but nights are great. So anytime you guys are going and just feel like popping me on, let me know.
That sounds awesome, man. Thanks again.
So that's part of the show where we whip around the rest of campus and we down the 40, and we start with the sport that's playing actual sports that count. The soccer team opens the season with some dramatic fashion, a 4-3 comeback win against Long Beach State, and then getting back to business, blasting Rice 6-0 in the home opener. Long Beach State, Texas breaking in a new keeper, Mia Justice, who struggled a bit, we'll just go ahead and say it like that, in the opener. Long Beach State scored 41 seconds in, and the fireworks just continued from that point.
Well, they scored so quick, and then I think that's all that happened at half. And then it's almost like after the first one, they couldn't score unless Texas scored. But Ashlyn Miller had the equalizer at 52. 90 seconds later, Cherry Cox from Long Beach had the equalizer, to go back ahead 2-1. Trinity Byers comes in for another equalizer, you know, 4 minutes later. And, you know, immediate response, now they're up 3-2. And Byers tied it up late in the game. It was literally, I think, Texas's latest goal in school history, at least in regulation time, with like 13 seconds to go in the 90th minute. Abby Allen knocked the go-ahead header in. That's UNC transfer defender Abby Allen with the go-ahead goal to open in dramatics. And Coach Kelly was basically saying, look, you know, we probably don't win that game in week one of last year. Like, we're further along. The team's already playing together. We would, you know, wouldn't necessarily love the dramatics all the time, but it was a nice test, and you get the win however you can.
I mean, it's good to test your mettle early and often, right? Again, you know, Coach Kelly said it, right? They didn't fold in this game, and so that was good to see. A lot of, you know, this is a relatively young, I mean, they're still a relatively young team. You know, they've got a lot of younger players. You know, they're getting some more reps in the trenches now, but, you know, overall, they're still a team that's figuring out how to win, and that's a good sign that they figured out how to win. And then they came back and absolutely blasted Rice in the next one, 6-0, which is more what we expected and what we're hoping to see from Texas this year. You know, Trinity Byers just decided to put the team on her back in this one. First three goals of the match, her hat trick was completed by minute 22, which is absolutely insane. She's now tied for the school lead in hat tricks, and just absolutely set the tone for Texas in that one.
Yeah, I mean, Trinity Byers is unbelievable. She has 5 goals in 2 matches. And look, Long Beach State, just FYI, is pretty good. They beat Boston College with one player scoring 4 goals in that one. So they're a good team. But Rice, we knew Texas would be the favorite by, you know, a margin there, but they dominated in this one. Rice tried to play a high line, and Byers just made him pay for it. The 22-minute hat trick, just unbelievable. And she can score when she wants. It almost felt like the second half she wanted to get other people involved. She felt a little selfish. She laid one off for Lexi Misimo, who you know, I've taken to calling her this season Lexi Messimo, because she's... Fair. Yeah, four assists in the scrimmage, and I think she's already got 3 this year. She's absolutely going to break that assist record at Texas, like, in 2 more games. But she scored in that one, played very well. Jillie Shimkin got a goal there. I think Misma had a brace. So, I mean, the players you expect, the one player who you expect to hear from and you don't right now, and for those who weren't following in the offseason may be wondering why, MJ Cox was, you know, predicted to be an All-American, right? Someone who expected to be one of the best defenders. Also played on that same club team with Byers and Misimo in the Dallas area growing up. And it's been a tough blow, right? Not only Mia Justice being a new keeper, but the best defender in the Big 12 by, you know, a wide margin has been out. She injured, I think, against OU in this spring season, her knee, and is still out. Don't know if she's going to miss exactly how long, but she played every single minute in the 2022 season, and you're already seeing it, right? They never gave up more than 2 goals last year. To give up 3 in the opener was, you know, they gave up 18 in 22 matches. That's already a good percentage of that. So the 0 in the second is better. Let's see if they can stay closer to that, figure out who, you know, who's going to shore up that defense with a new keeper in there, really get some understanding of the identity. The scoring should be no problem for this team. Let's see how their defense holds up.
Yeah, I mean, we don't expect a clean sheet every trip, but, you know, I think somewhere in the middle, right? I'll take 1.5 goals if Texas is averaging 5, right, over 2 matches. Again, averages are worthless in 2 matches in. Like, that's a better ratio for me. So next up for Texas, they'll host LSU on Thursday and then Iona on Sunday, keeping the home train going. The ladies, again, leading the charge for Texas. Number 1, Texas volleyball beats Texas A&M Corpus Christi in an exhibition. And then they open up the regular season against Long Beach State and Loyola Marymount, which is also in Long Beach, on Friday.
Yeah, Loyola and Long Beach together. Now you know you're in trouble, I believe, Snoop Dogg said. No, there must be, like we said, some kind of discount trip. Southwest frequent flyer, I don't know. But volleyball following soccer and staying out there for a while. 2 matches in Long Beach to open the season. But played 5 sets against Temuck in the exhibition, won all 5 sets. They look good. There's going to be some new faces in this team for sure, replacing Eggleston and Fleck. There will be some familiar faces. I think this is Molly Phillips' year to really break out and be an All-American as she dominates inside, along with, of course, Maddie Skinner, you know, stepping in and being the preeminent outside hitter in the conference and maybe the country. Like, there's still a ton of talent. This is still Texas's team, you know, title to lose. So love the culture that Elliott has built, and, you know, took 10 years to get that win to finally break through. Let's make it a much shorter duration by just going ahead and repeating this year.
Go back to back on it. On the outdoor volleyball team, they're starting to load that roster and get ready to keep things going. So Stein Metzger is the coach, if you didn't know that. Signed 9 transfer players to the roster on Monday. They all were officially announced. I'm not going to go through every name, but it has a distinctly local flavor, keeping it in state. Players that went out of state to play beach volleyball able to come home. 4 of them from Austin, 1 from Dallas, 1 from Rockwall, 1 from San Antonio, 1 from Frisco, and then the lonely out-of-state player from Costa Mesa, California. But I think it's interesting to see this kind of reverse or this influx of talent, especially Central Texas talent, like people from the backyard that went out of state. A couple of them went to TCU, but, like, you know, mostly they went out of state to play beach volleyball. So this, I feel like there's going to be an on-ramp, right? They're not going to be the indoor volleyball team. They're not going to be Jared Elliott's crew, but I think the on-ramp to competence is going to be much shorter for this team than we're expecting.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think you said it exactly right. Right, like I think two of those Austin players were at UCLA who were the runner-ups for the national championship last year. Right,
they're coached by Metzger, I believe.
Correct. Right, so it makes a lot of sense that you're getting Texas kids who are going out to play for these preeminent programs. Now you can get them to stay home because Texas will be one in short order. When Del Conte was at TCU, they started that program. They're a new program. They're not a long powerhouse, but the TCU sand volleyball team is one of the best in the country. Happened very quickly. I wonder if Texas being on the scene will both weaken TCU's stance and also just, again, make them kind of the preeminent destination for anyone in the state of Texas, as you would imagine, with a great coach, with all the resources as they build that up. It almost feels like it's not a matter of if, but when, and not even when as much as this year or 3 years. You know, it's like it's coming and exciting to watch.
Very exciting indeed. But now we bring you to the part of the show where we honor one of the best traditions in all of college athletics, Big Bertha, and we bang the drum, brought to you by Joe Ruiz. So Kyle, what are you banging the drum on this week?
I've said before in this podcast, I didn't necessarily grow up a Longhorn fan. I had an affinity. My dad was from Pennsylvania, was a Penn State guy. So as a kid, my number one program was Penn State. And then, you know, Texas was cool. I remember, I think I've told this story in the podcast before, I caught a pass from Vince Young before that 2005 season when they scrimmaged my brother's team with 7-on-7 against Texas State. And there was about 40 of us there watching it and got to talk to the guys after the game. And I believe that was the moment that I was like, all right, I'm a Texas fan, guys, through and through. So there's a big part of my Texas history that I missed growing up that I just didn't know. And one of the people who filled that in with his prose, with his, you know, voracious documentation of detail was Bill Little. And Bill Little passed away at the age of 81 this week. And if you're not familiar with Bill Little, I mean, it's synonymous with the era of you want Texas information, you go to MacBrownTexasFootball.com. Like Bill Little to me, though he was the you know, the editor at the Daily Texan in the 60s, he to me is certainly he is Mac Brown Texas football. He is the 90s and 80s Texas football, and even was, you know, in not the main SID until the 80s, but before that was on staff as an assistant SID in those national championship teams in the 60s. He was there in the 70s. You know, he knows. We lost as much knowledge about UT football as probably any single human could have taken with them, right? He was a tremendous writer. He had a specific, as much as Keith Jackson could say a phrase and you knew exactly who was saying it, you could read something Bill Little wrote. And prose may be flowery or you know, like you was meant to hear the NFL Films song behind it and a voiceover to it. It was distinctive and informative, and to a person, nothing but glowing praise of mentorship and kindness and openness to sharing. And I mean, the press box of the baseball stadium and the football field are named after Bill Little for a reason. A true, true Longhorn legend has left us. Do yourself a favor and just go back through the archives and Google Bill Little. He's got a bunch of books out, I think, as well, but just some of his articles he wrote. Again, for me, in that era of the Mac Brown team, was, you know, reading the things that he wrote about those icons and heroes when I was in my formative years, really is what made him stand out to me. But take a second, educate yourself. If you're a newer Longhorn fan, if you're a younger Longhorn fan, I'm sure all of our fans who are of a certain vintage are very, very aware of Bill Little and just the impact that he had. Gerald and I are familiar with Bianca, who is his protege and took over as the athletic director kind of as we were getting to college. But Bill Little still had a special role. He never left, even after he retired, was always around the University of Texas and University of Texas Athletics. A special person. A great loss for the Longhorn Nation.
Yeah, I every interaction I had with Bill Little, I was privileged enough to be able to cover the football team as a student reporter for a couple of years, and like, you know, Bill was just always there, and he was just the nicest guy. Like, he'd always go out of his way to make sure he said hi to folks, and you know, even if he didn't know you, he was always like, they're just the nicest guy. This is like reductive, but it's like that granddad energy that you want, and he's just the nicest guy in the world. So massive loss, massive loss, massive shadow hanging over this season with the loss of Bill Little, but absolutely cannot say anything but incredible things about him. So I'm banging the drum this week on something that's less consequential, and I feel silly talking about it after Kyle. But there was this weird conversation that sparked on the internet this week where the concept of t-shirt fans keeps coming up in college football conversation. And my stance on this is I don't know, whatever. I'm just going to say it, right? Like, there is no brand that can exist without t-shirt fans, right? In sports, we're all cheering for laundry. It is what it is, right? No matter who is in those uniforms, you're going to be there. And the simple fact that the reason why the University of Texas is the most lucrative brand in the world is because people can go to Walmart and pick up those shirts, and all the chest thumping we do about the national branding and the national recognition and how much money the athletic department brings in and can spend and all those things is because of the t-shirt fans, right? If it was just, if the only folks that were allowed, if the only folks that cheered for the school were the 26% of folks that are admitted to the University of Texas football and athletic program would not be what it is today, period, end of sentence, right? I cannot stress enough how frustrating it is for me to denigrate folks who were not privileged enough for whatever reason it might be. Like, I consider it one of the biggest privileges of my life to have gone to the University of Texas. And I know, like, I pray for that my children will have that opportunity, right? Like, it is one of the things that, like, it will, you know, I want to position them in any way I can to do that, because it's one of the best things I've experienced in my life as a, you know, before, you know, getting married and becoming a father. Like, that was one of the biggest privileges of my life. And so it is wild to me to say things about people who did not have the ability, right? Because, you know, somebody went and served overseas in the military and they didn't, you know, didn't go to college. So they're somehow lesser of a fan. They grew up in Austin, they grew up in Texas, or somebody, you know, went to trade school and they're doing, you know, incredible work in the trades and the skilled trades, you know, but they're somehow less of a fan because they didn't, you know, shell out all of the money that we all did and do that, right? So it's just wild to me that continues to be a thing. And I don't see it as much from Texas fans. And there are Texas fans that do that. But when push comes to shove, like, fans are fans. And if you've gone through the last decade and a half with 13 years of Texas football and you still wear that thing with pride, you're good with me. And I'll close with this. I lived in Oklahoma for 13 years. And let me tell you, anytime I wore Longhorn gear out in public, I got the horns down from anybody, right? Grandmas, you know, grandparents, young, old, everything in between. And they didn't stop and ask me if I went to the university. They didn't even, they saw me from down the Walmart aisle, had never said a word, and would flash the horns down at me. And so that, to me, is validating of that. Like, it doesn't matter if you went to the school or not, if you've never been to Austin or not. We have folks that listen to this podcast that have never, you know, that live overseas and they've never been on the 40 acres. And that the validity there is just the same as folks who spent their time going to school there. And that's all I've got to say about that.
It's a really great point you made, Gerald, that, you know, if you're a fan of Manchester City in the English Premier League, and, you know, it's like, wow, you're a bandwagon fan because they won a bunch. Like, if you want to call Texas fans t-shirt fans, okay, but you certainly right now can't call them bandwagon fans for football. It has not been a very large bandwagon with very many seats. If you're here and you've gone through the down times, you get to enjoy the up times, no matter, you know, what you did between the ages of 18 and 22. Now, I agree with you. I think it's a silly thing. Someone texted me when we were tweeting about it and said, this is the first time I've even heard this term. And I was like, oh, sweet summer child. You went to Arizona State and maybe you didn't get as many interactions with Aggies or OU fans who are so fond of such a term or Tech fans or whatever. But yeah, welcome to the Big 12. But no, I think you're right, Gerald. And I think any fan of the Texas Longhorns, t-shirt, diploma'd, tall, short, fat, skinny, I don't really give a gosh darn. Show up. Listen to our podcast. You're welcome here.
And that's all we got for you this week. Kyle, where can the good folks find you on the internet?
Oh, you can follow me on all of the socials media at Kyle Carpenter. You can also follow the Texas Pregamer on Twitter at Texas Pregamer.
Follow me on Twitter at GH Goodrich. Follow the show on Twitter at Longhorn Pod. Stitches, Facebook, Instagram, the Longhorn Republic. Shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. Thank you so much for tuning in again this week. And until next time, hook 'em.
Hook 'em. Shouts to Gracie's Corner.